changes. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 558 of Unwelcome Guests Into Eternity. I'm Robin Upton. The subtitle of this week's show is Understanding the Ongoing Nuclear Wars, and we're going to look at two aspects. Firstly, the ongoing use of depleted uranium, aka nuclear waste, in battlefield situations such as Iraq and Afghanistan. And secondly, we're going to take a look at the dilemma of handling nuclear waste produced by commercial power plants. It's a slightly more moody and reflective show for you this week. I was saddened to hear of the death of Brian Hoare last month, whose determination and defiance has been an encouragement for me, and I think for many in the anti-war movement. He, in 2001, took up residence on the pavement in UK Parliament Square in London, opposite the Houses of Parliament, where the warmongers, at that time it was sanctions against Iraq, he was protesting about. But he remained there for nearly a decade, and was a continual embarrassment to the warmongers opposite. And the authorities' response is illuminating. After trying various legal strategies to remove him, they created a new section of the Serious Organized Crime and Police Act, which explicitly outlawed protests within a certain distance of Parliament. Does anybody think they didn't introduce that law with him in mind? No, of course. Their actions expose the partisan nature of the law. The fact that it is made by people, oftentimes socio or psychopathic people, whose conduct should leave no doubt that they're creating these laws not for public good, but for their own private good. Anyway, the law was badly drafted, couldn't be applied retrospectively, and he didn't start a new protest there, it was ongoing. So, long legal battle, they've arrested him a few times, spent enormous amounts of taxpayers' money. When they wanted to evict him once, 78 policemen turned up in the middle of the night. Now, this is a recording, it's not quite an interview. There's a few questions asked by veteran Bilderberg watcher Tony Gosling, but Brian Hoare doesn't always respond in the way I think Tony had hoped. It's, unlike most of the things on the show, not a carefully crafted speech. More of a rant, really, but it gets across some of the emotions. Why does somebody take part in a one-man political protest for a decade? How does it feel to be standing in the rain in a homemade shelter by the side of the road whilst in a huge building a few metres away murderous laws and policies are carried out by a rich, smug, self-serving elite who seem to be lacking any kind of moral sensitivity?
I'm underwhelmed. Underwhelmed. 2 million people? Do you recall that?
I do.
30,000? Wow. Because things are so much better today, aren't they? Things have resolved. Things are so much happier for the people in Afghanistan and Iraq. Has anybody noticed what's going on? Carnage, bloodshed, we're wiping them all out. We our country is wiping all these people out, just like those people wiped out those people called Americans. Do you remember that one all those years back? The people who used to have the feathers in their hair and the wigwams. The Americans. Murdered, slaughtered, carnage, genocide by these invaders from our country amongst other countries, yeah?
So what's it like having everybody here today? Do you feel like a sense of solidarity?
You're not listening, are you? Everybody is not here. Most people are not here, are they? We said 30,000, 2 million. Now, how many people in this country know what's going on is so awful, so wrong? They don't know how awful, because quite frankly, the media doesn't show us very much, does it? The media doesn't show us the blood in the body on the... Oh, it shows us a bit of blood on the streets, but it doesn't show us the blown-up babies, does it? It doesn't show us the bodies. It doesn't show us the sheer and utter carnage. They're all dying over there. But hey, folks, our conscience are okay, aren't they? Because we come out on a march, and we can feel, oh, I've done my bit. 30,000, 2 million? How many millions are dead? Do you know what? When 2 million took to the streets, that was good, wasn't it? Bloody good. From all sections of the community, all our people, we stood up. And that 2 million people represented so many more, didn't it? How many people there were waving them off on the coaches? How many people were demonstrating in other cities in our country on that magical day, yeah? And then people came to me and says, they're going to do it. Oh, what can you do? They didn't listen. Why didn't we come back with 5 million? 10 million? Why didn't we? Why didn't we? 30,000? Wow. I'm underwhelmed. Are we really going to give a shit? All these people are going to be dead by the time we actually do something about it. Because the bottom line is, of course, Bush and Blair committed the same crime that the Nazis were hung for at Nuremberg. Do you know the number one crime? To initiate a war of aggression is the number one crime. From that crime, all the other war crimes come. Yeah? It's common sense, isn't it, when you think about it? 45 minutes, Mr. Blair. 45 minutes, Mr. Blyer. Dodgy dossiers. Plagiarized thesis. 45 minutes, sexy lie. And for that, all the innocents have to die. That's how it started, isn't it? 5 years ago now. 5 years ago. 5 years. Do you know what? I'm sure the people of Iraq and Afghanistan are so grateful to us. After murdering at least 2 million of their people, we're here saying, oh, it's naughty, stop. And then we're going away again, aren't we?
Are you going away or not?
I wish I could. With all my heart, I wish I could go away. 7 years, 24/7 on this pavement. What's happening over there? Well, everybody's being murdered. Check out the arms industry, the number one money-making business in the world. It's all about money. Check out the drugs industry, the second biggest money-making racket in the world. Check out the drugs coming from Afghanistan. That's what it's all about. The Taliban regime, this wicked, awful regime, cut the drugs back to 150 tons, the poppy production, yeah? It's gone up to 5,000-6,000 tons and growing now. We've liberated them. Second biggest money-making racket. Oh, some people are making a fortune out of this. And on our streets, the people are being controlled with the drugs. We did that to the Chinese people all those years ago with opium, didn't we? Turned them into zombies. And our people are f***ing zombies. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Drinking? Drugs? When are we going to wake up and care? When are we going to be human? I'm here because I'm personally responsible for what my country is doing to other people, am I not? I can't just blame it all on Blair, who's gone now. But his genocide lives on, doesn't it? Check out depleted uranium munitions. It's our war material. It's made of our nuclear waste. We dropped a couple of thousands of tons of our nuclear shit on people in other countries.
It all does sound a bit depressing. Have you got any sort of positive vision for the future? Do you think things may turn around?
Oh, yes, it's very depressing, isn't it? And all those poor, depressed people over there. I tell you what, when the bombs are falling on you, you get a bit depressed. And over here, we get a bit... Oh, it's going to rain. It started spitting, isn't it? Everybody's going to run away home soon. They're going to run away home. When are we going to care? When are we going to wake up? When are we going to stop What Bush and Blair are doing is far worse than Hitler ever did. Check out depleted uranium. I didn't tell you, did I? Depleted uranium, the Royal Society tells us, has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. We poison these people's countries forever. See what it does to the babe? For God's sake, look to see what we're doing to the babies. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. Go to Southeast Asia. You'll see the same effect from Agent Orange there. Same. Go to Serbia, Sarajevo, Yugoslavia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq. Depleted uranium munitions. Depressing. I'm sorry to spoil your day. Sorry to make you a bit miserable.
What I wanted to get from you is, do you have a positive vision for the future? Do you think things may turn around?
What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? I don't want to know your answer. That's between you and your maker, between you and your conscience. Have you noticed what... Check out the Statutes of Rome, Article 25. That talks about individual criminal responsibility. If my country is committing genocide and I'm paying money towards, tax money towards buying the weapons, buying the depleted uranium munitions, the bombs, I'm personally responsible. In the same way as the German people were personally responsible for what Hitler and the Nazis did. And they had a collective punishment after the end of the Second World War. Do we know about that? What I would say is for our people to have a heart. Are we really monsters? See, we're already thinning out. The rain's coming and the people are running away because it's uncomfortable, isn't it? I tell you what, it's bloody uncomfortable in Iraq and Afghanistan. Ask our soldiers how comfortable they are. Ask them, do they want to be there? Is anybody going to give a shit about our soldiers? General Danett ran away from me the other day. Have you heard of him? General Danett Donut, our top general. Oxford Union, he should have been speaking against me. This House would, under no circumstances, fight for Queen and country. That was the motion. I was speaking for it. Danett was supposed to be speaking against it. He didn't turn up. The Air Marshal, he was supposed to be turning up instead of Danett. He didn't turn up.
Do you think our public figures are afraid to debate these subjects?
Colonel Bob Andrews, the action man from Basra, he was going to come. He didn't turn up. He had business in the Middle East, apparently. Yeah, it's called genocide. That's what it's called. It's called bomb, burn, bugger, beggar your neighbour. That's what it's called. But he's just doing what he's told. And most of us do what we're told, don't we? And we march nice and peacefully between the crowd barriers like we're supposed to do. We're penned in. Do you know the way to change things? No, it's not with a revolution. It's not with force, not with violence. It's with peace. That's what buggers them off about me, you know. Absolute. Are you an absolute pacifist, Brian? Oh, can you be a partial pacifist? Are you against all war? Well, check out war. Check out what it's for. War's for making money. That's what war's for. Check out the innocents who die in war. And it's the most innocent who do most of the dying. Have you noticed that? The babes, the infants, the old people, the weak, the sick, the poor. These are the people who do the big dying in war. The ones in uniform. And they've been taught to protect themselves, haven't they? To keep their head down. Well, some of them have. Some of them haven't had a chance to, have they? Their head's blown off before they've had a chance to learn. But are you going to give a damn for that soldier boy? Could be your child, couldn't he? He is our child. So is this little Arabian child as well. That's our child. Are we human beings, Britain? Wake up. Stop the genocide. Do something about it. And do it while there's still some people left.
Brian Hall, you will be sorely missed by many. May more of us have clarity, determination, and above all, love. I find it remarkable how many people from different areas, different nationalities, different thought patterns seem to be converging on the realization that all of life, certainly all of humanity, is one, and that grief, suffering, destruction is the inevitable result from hiding from that truth. And now we are going to check out depleted uranium, We're going to hear more on the topic from radiation safety researcher Chris Busby, as interviewed on the programme Politics and Science by John Barkhausen.
Today I'm featuring an interview with Dr. Chris Busby. It was recorded on April 1st, 2011. Dr. Busby is the Scientific Secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk, and since the interview he's come out with a forecast for the health damage that's being done at Fukushima within the 200 kilometers contamination zone. He's forecasting 417,000 additional cancers within that zone during the next 50 years until 2061. Dr. Busby developed his knowledge in the areas of radiation biology and epidemiology, and presently heads a company called Green Audit, does research in the field of low-level radiation and health. He disagrees rather profoundly with the current mainstream science that's put out by the United Nations. In this interview, I've asked him about that. There was recently a news show featuring George Monbiot debating Helen Caldicott, and he addresses some of the issues of the disagreements that those two had with each other. So here is Dr. Chris Busby. This is a rather short show. It's only about 35 minutes. So I thought the most important thing to do today was to try to answer some of the things we're hearing in the press. We just heard a debate on a news show that we have here in the U.S. called Democracy Now!, and it featured George
Monbiot.
Thank you. It's French.
Monbiot.
I know George. And talking to Helen Caldicott.
And, yeah, sure. Okay. I know both of them.
And the essential debate boiled down to the fact that she basically didn't believe the UN UNSEER report about the effects of radiation, and he does. He feels that only 43 people died at Chernobyl. This is George's position, Monbiot's position.
Yeah. Right.
And he was astounded that anyone could doubt the UN agency, because, of course, that's mainstream science, and how could you possibly doubt the veracity of their report? And he accused Helen Caldicott of being a conspiracy theorist, and I was wondering if you could just respond to that.
Okay, well, I'm responding to George Monbiot's belief in the accuracy of the results of the United Nations Chernobyl Forum, we have to say here, who are partly the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, but also the French nuclear industry and also the International Atomic Energy Agency. Monbiot believes that their report saying that only a few liquidators died and a few people, a few children, developed thyroid cancer. He believes this because he is ignorant of the scientific literature. The scientific literature on the effects of the Chernobyl accident is massive. There are several hundred scientific papers that show that the effects of the Chernobyl accident are absolutely ghastly, absolutely enormous. Not just from cancer, but from a whole range of other diseases. I give you two examples, which are difficult ones to argue against. One is from Sweden, where Martin Pondell and his colleagues from Linköping University looked at cancer risk in the small areas of northern Sweden by radiation exposure to the contamination on the ground. And they found that for every 100 kilobecquerels of contamination by cesium, there was an 11% increase in cancer. 100 kilobecquerels is 100,000 disintegrations per second for every square meter of ground. This is material that came from Chernobyl. This is an awful lot of radioactivity, 100,000 disintegrations per second. And most people would think that that might cause some harm to human beings living there, and of course they wouldn't be wrong. The other study, which I myself carried out, is an examination of reports from five or six different independent groups of increases in infant leukemia. That's leukemia in children who were in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl fallout. And this was published in two peer-reviewed journals. It was ignored by the United Nations, and Tondell's study was ignored by the United Nations. And in fact, the United Nations ignore anything that doesn't fit in with their risk model. And what we found was that in all of these different studies in Europe, from Greece, from Germany, from Scotland, from Wales, from England, we also had a study in Belarus, and we had a study in America too, in the United States, by Joe Mangano. All of these showed increases, statistically significant increases in childhood, in infant leukemia, leukemia in the first year of life. And there were various relative risks, but they were all highly significant. And the only possible explanation for that is the Chernobyl accident, because these children were chosen because they were in the womb at the time of the Chernobyl accident. So these are just two studies I mentioned. But there are a whole range of studies that have been carried out by other groups, and most recently Alexei Yablokov has published a compendium of all these studies and review of all these studies, which was published under the auspices of the New York Academy of Sciences. So the problem is with Monbiot is that he doesn't know anything. And that is the problem with most of these people that I see talking about the Fukushima accident, is they themselves don't seem to know anything. They don't look at the research themselves. They don't do the research themselves. All they do is they listen to authorities.
I mean, it's obvious that he doesn't know what you're saying to be true.
No, he does know what I'm saying to be true. He does know what I'm saying. Because about 4 years ago, I talked to George. He got in touch with me, mm-hmm. and he asked me about this a long time ago when he was first thinking about examining the idea of nuclear energy. And he asked me to provide a report for him and to talk to him about it, which I did. And I provided the report, references, everything. So the fact is, he's just ignored this.
I see. It's odd. Helen Caldicott asked him if he was aware of the Chernobyl report that you're referring to, Chernobyl, the consequences of the catastrophe for people and the environment, by Alexei Yablokov. And he said, yes, he had a copy, and he hadn't read it all, but he'd read most of it. So, but I think he feels like a lot of people do, and I'm not sure what the reason is for this, that because it's outside of what he considers to be the mainstream, which in his case, I guess anything UN is mainstream, that he feels like to accept those results, which are in contradiction with the UN report, UN saying, you know, 43 to 9,000 people were affected, and the Chernobyl report by Yablokov saying over 1 million people have died. He says to accept that is it the equivalent of believing the global warming deniers, which he calls fringe science as well.
Well, I wouldn't like to comment on the global warming deniers. The fact is that the United Nations are not themselves experts. What they do is they review other studies, and they cherry-pick the studies which support their position, and they ignore the studies which don't support their position. Mm. And in fact, the number of scientists, or I say scientists, but the number of individuals, they're really not scientists. They are scientific servants, really. They don't do any research themselves. If you look up the individuals involved in these reports, they are not hands-on scientists like Yablokov and the people that he reports. They are just people who sit behind desks and look at bits of paper, and then they take from those bits of paper what they believe supports their position, and ignore what they don't believe supports their position. And so if that's a conspiracy theory, then that is what I hold, what I believe. You know, I don't know if it's a conspiracy, but it certainly has to do with the culture of the people associated with these kinds of reviews.
Just this morning on a local station here, we heard somebody named Patrick Moore, who said he was formerly of Greenpeace, and he is now on the air claiming that coal and even hydro are way more dangerous than nuclear. He claimed he had an irrational fear of nuclear power because environmentalists tend to lump nuclear power with nuclear weapons, and that he's now recovered from this paranoia, and he sees, like George Monbiot, he sees nuclear power as the answer to our global warming crisis and power needs. And what do you make of this remarkable wave of people who look at the disaster in Fukushima and see it as somehow a sign that nuclear power is the answer at the same time that it's melting down and poisoning the environment?
Well, I think we have to go back to Kierkegaard for that. We go back to this philosopher who was concerned about belief. He is the belief philosopher. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he decided and wrote about was that the more insane a proposition is, the more strongly people hold the belief in it. And so as the assault on their belief system becomes more and more violent, the more they have to hold to the belief system that they have, because otherwise they would be in some way cancelling out their identity. And people's identity is very, you know, is perhaps the strongest drive of all, stronger than eating, stronger than sex. You look in the mirror, you say, who am I? If you're the person who has written extensively about how great nuclear power is, and suddenly something comes along which shows you that it isn't, what you have to do is you have to shout even louder into your own ears to support it. And I think this is what's happening. It's what the psychologists call denial, I think, nowadays.
And I suppose the same claim could be thrown back at you, that as they say that nuclear power is the answer, you're saying that radiation causes extensive disease in humans and in the rest of the environment. What's your basis for saying that?
My basis is the research. I spent 20 years doing research on this issue. I've done epidemiological research on this issue. I've done cell biology. I've done theoretical work. I've done an enormous amount of work. I've devoted an enormous and rather too much of my life, I have to say, part of my life to all of this, when I would have much rather been sitting on the beach with my girlfriend and a bottle of wine. Mm. And I don't get very much money out of this, I have to say, either. So it's not something that I do for money. I do it because of the children. I do it because I got interested in it and I find it quite fascinating. But I am a researcher. And so when I say these things, they come from a basis in scientific research and an enormous amount of this. Whereas these people who talk about these things, they actually have no basis whatever except kind of blind belief in authority.
One thing I've noticed, Dr. Chris Busby, is that all of these ill effects that are happening in Chernobyl, they say that there was a thyroid problem in Chernobyl, but there's a lot of other diseases that are happening that the official studies at the UN don't recognize as being caused by radiation. And the same thing happens at Three Mile Island in the United States. And they have an explanation for these diseases, and that's stress from fear of radiation, which seems very odd to me that even though there's a great increase in disease, they don't blame it on the actual radiation, they blame it on the fear of it.
Well, of course they're wrong, and you can see that there's going to be the same thing will happen at Fukushima. However, the main point that you can make, that I can make, is this, is that nobody ever got cancer from radiophobia. And there is enormous evidence that animals and fish and plants are becoming mutated as a result of the radiation from Chernobyl. There's lots of scientific reports, research reports that show this. For example, swallows, a long time ago, were shown to have little white blotches on their skin, on their plumage, as a result of the radiation from Chernobyl. We know that bank voles, which have been studied extensively, have developed what's called genomic instability. And 22 generations of these animals have got this genomic instability, so it makes them particularly responsive to radiation, rather more responsive than ones who hadn't been irradiated. And their genetic, there are a lot of chromosome damage tests that have been done. There was an interesting chromosome test, the DNA test, that was done in Israel, where they looked at the liquidators' children who were born after the accident compared with the children who were born before the accident, and showed a 7 times increase in genetic damage there. You don't get that from radiophobia. You can't alter your genes because you're frightened of radioactivity.
So I wanted you to explain a little bit. They make very light of low-dose radiation. They say, of course, the Fukushima accident, some people will die from that because of the high doses, but low-dose radiation is often dismissed as having any effect at all on people. In fact, some people claim that it's even stimulating to the immune system and beneficial.
The problem is the concept of dose. It's now generally recognized that you cannot use this concept of dose. So the idea of low dose, high dose, this dose, that dose, is rather like saying all poisons are the same. It's rather like saying that I can have 1 gram of salt or 1 gram of sodium iodide or 1 gram of sodium cyanide, and because it's 1 gram, and that's the dose, they'll all have the same effect. And for internal radiation, of course, the effect isn't the same. And the reason for that is because dose is energy per unit mass. So you can sit in front of a fire and warm yourself and get so many joules per kilogram, energy per unit mass, or you could reach into the fire and eat a hot coal, and that would also give you the same energy per unit mass. It would be a lot more energy, but it would all be in one place. And so there are a number of ways in which internal radiation can't be modeled in terms of dose. And in fact, the United Nations, if you like to call their risk model the ICRP risk model, International Commission on Radiological Protection, they have conceded this. I had an interview with their scientific secretary just after he had resigned, and this was in April 2009 in Stockholm, and he conceded, and it's all on video. So if you go to vimeo.com and you type in Busby and Valentin, his name was Jack Valentin, you can watch the whole video where he concedes that the ICRP risk model cannot be used for internal radiation exposures. It cannot be used for accidents like Fukushima and Chernobyl. And he also concedes that now that he's no longer the scientific secretary, that the United Nations were wrong in not addressing all of the evidence that came out of Chernobyl. So he concedes all of these things, and it's all there on the internet on video, so you can watch him say it. So the problem then is that these internal radionuclides, they can cause a lot of energy in one place, and we call those things hot particles, or they can bind to DNA. So they have chemical affinity for DNA. Examples are barium-140, strontium-90, uranium, all of the uranium sub, they bind to DNA very strongly. And so when they deliver their energy, it's not just anywhere into the body, which is mostly concerned made of water, they deliver it directly into the DNA, and therefore they cause the damage at a much, much higher rate than you would expect from their dose. So saying that the low dose is very low and is not the same as flying to across the Atlantic or whatever other analogy that is used is missing the point that you cannot use dose for internal radionuclides. You can for some of them, but you can't for some of them. And those are the ones that are really dangerous, the uranium, the strontium-90, and various other ones that also have this affinity for DNA.
So your main point as the scientific secretary of the European Committee on Radiation Risk is that the whole dose risk model is wrong, that's being used by mainstream science right now.
Yes, it's wrong, and this has actually been the probably the largest public health scandal in human history. As a result of this, probably more than 60 million people have died unnecessarily because of this business of dose and external and internal radiation.
I was going to ask, what would be the ramifications if your risk model was adopted?
If our risk model was adopted,
yeah,
then it would give the correct answer to the question: how many people will die following an internal exposure? If you take this, if you take the situation of Tondell and the studies in northern Sweden, this is a huge study of the whole population of northern Sweden over about 10 years. Massive statistical significance, been published
in relation to Chernobyl.
Yeah. Okay. And they know what the doses are. They know what the concentrations on the ground are. You can work out the doses and so on. And what you find is that the ECRR risk model exactly predicted what Tondell would find. And the risk model was written in 2003, before Tondell's paper came out. Mm. And where you look at Chernobyl, where you look at the Marshall Islands, where you look at the test veterans, where you look at all these other situations where you get internal exposure, what you find is that the ECRR risk model gives you the right answer. And I take it into court, because I do a lot of work as expert witness now, and I take this book, the Blue Book now, the 2010 book, I take it into court, I talk to the jury and I talk to the judge, or I put it forward in my research, in my expert evidence, and usually, well, in fact, nearly always, we win. Mm-hmm. We win. And usually they don't allow it to get to court, they just settle out of court. So I've done probably 30 cases in which they've settled out of court or just packed it up, because they don't want to have to go into court to allow that as a precedent, because then all of the dominoes will go down and then there will be such a huge attack on the nuclear industry that they would be finished. Because so many people have died as a result of this.
How many people did you say again have died according to this risk model?
Between 1952 and about, I think, 1994 was when we did the cutoff, because that's when the data cut off. It's just about 65 million cancer deaths.
Jeez.
Globally, this is.
Yes. And
where can you see those? You want to know, you know, where are they? Well, I mean, you only have to look around you. You only have to think about your own family. You only have to think about your dogs and cats. But after about the biggest injection of radionuclides into the atmosphere was in between 1959 and 1963 with the weapons fallout. Mm-hmm. And then about 10-15 years after that, the cancer rate started to rise, and they went up and up and up and up and up. And in the northern hemisphere, you're talking about a 30% rise in cancer. And you've only got to multiply the population of the northern hemisphere by the cancer risk by 30% that you get your 60 million. Everybody's dying of cancer now.
But Chris, we're winning the war on cancer. You forget.
Of course they are.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, and oh look, there's a pig. Woo, there it goes.
Hey, I don't believe you. So, and I don't suppose it's possible to attribute which particles came from where, but do you have any estimate of what the damaged nuclear power itself is doing, not when there's a disaster like this, but just in the regular course
just generally.
Of events?
There are two types of problems with nuclear power. The first is the problem from reprocessing plants, which is the worst problem. So you have various plants where they do the fueling or the reprocessing of the fuel and so on, and those pump out all sorts of radionuclides, usually to the sea. So I've studied Sellafield in the United Kingdom, which has pumped a lot of stuff into the sea, radionuclides. I mean, they're not allowed to do it now, but they still put some out in there. And what I was able to show was that in Wales, which is the country that I've studied, between 1974 and 1989, there were approximately 5,000 extra cancers in the coastal strip of Wales where this material ended up on the coast. And this is relevant to Fukushima, incidentally, because all this stuff is going into the sea and it's all going to end up on the coast. And then people will inhale this because it comes ashore as a consequence of sea-to-land transfer. The sea energy lifts these things up as particles and they drift ashore. And they fall out in about the first or second kilometer from the sea. So the risk is specifically associated with people living very close to the sea. And as I said, there were about 5,000 cancers, about 3,000 cancer deaths in that 16-year period in quite a small population, the Welsh population. And we found the same effect in Ireland on the other side of the Irish Sea too, but we didn't find it on the Atlantic coast or on the southern coast of Ireland. So it's definitely an Irish Sea effect due to the Sellafield radionuclides. The other thing is nuclear power stations themselves. What we found is that we've just studied breast cancer, prostate and lung cancer, stomach cancer. And what we found is that for breast cancer is the worst one. You get a doubling of breast cancer downwind of the nuclear power station. And I think that Jay Gould did an enormous study in the United States some years ago. He's dead now. And he found the same thing, but a doubling of breast cancer. And the reason is that the female breast is highly lymphatically perfused. So there are lots and lots of lymphatic channels inside the breast. And these can take the particles which are inhaled from the lung into the breast and cause irradiation of the type I was talking about, the sort of hot coal irradiation.
Mm-hmm. So that's downwind from nuclear power plants that are operating normally, not having accidents.
No, of course, having accidents, you're going to get, you know, bad stuff. But I have to say, there's a problem with big accidents, and that is this, that it's not a linear dose response. I mean, this is another thing the United Nations say, is that double the dose, double the risk, treble the risk. But it's not like that. What happens is that it goes up linearly at low doses, but then it drops again. And the reason it drops is because the cells start to get killed. And that is also true of people as well, and it's also true of babies. So if you put a baby in the womb and it's growing, and you start to poison it with small amounts of radionuclides, or anything actually, what will happen is when the baby is born, it will have various problems. But then, of course, if you keep increasing the concentration of what it is, eventually you'll kill the baby in the womb, and so the baby won't be born. But if you're just looking at the problems in children, you won't see that. All you'll see is that it will go down. So you could then say, you know, the bigger the dose, the less the effect. So if you give a really big dose, you don't get any leukemias in children. And the reason is because you kill them all in the womb.
Yeah, Ernest Sternglass did a study in the United States, I believe, concerning the nuclear bombing, bomb test fallout, that showed that probably up to 375,000 stillbirths were accounted for by
yes, that's
fallout.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And Sternglass was what put me onto this originally, incidentally. He's my hero, Ernest. I mean, I met him long ago, and I've worked with him, and I've followed along behind him. Really, you know, he blazed the way. Because he's that rare thing, a scientist and also an activist, you know. So he gets stuck in when he thinks there's something wrong, and he's found it's wrong with his research. Then he gets stuck in and tries to change it. Too many scientists, they just get frightened at that point, and they go and hide in their laboratories and don't say anything. So he's a hero of mine.
Yeah, he's a remarkable man. What about Alice Stewart, who did a lot of pioneering of the danger of medical radiation? That's had a huge effect, and I think that actually affected Ernest Sternglass's work, didn't she?
Yes, I think he used her calculations, which he did, after the Second World War on childhood leukemia, in order to influence his, in order to inform his own calculations, which he took to President Kennedy. And Sternglass told me it was his article that was sent by, to Kennedy that resulted in Kennedy's decision to halt the bomb testing and to sign it, sign the testing test ban. So in fact, Ernest has. They ought to put a statue up to Ernest. I mean, he's still alive, but they can still put a statue up to him. I followed along his work on infant mortality in England, and I went to see what it was caused by, and what I discovered was that the infant mortality in England was caused by strontium 90, and it was related to heart defects mainly, congenital heart defects. So I plotted the strontium 90 in milk in England and Wales against the congenital heart defects and got an absolute 100% correlation. Never seen anything like it. It's never been published. A lot of this stuff doesn't get published because certainly in the past, if you sent it to the journals, they were all dominated by nuclear people, you know, in this area, and they would just throw it out. Nowadays, it's getting a lot easier to get stuff published, but it's still not that easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think people are under the... They operate under the assumption that peer-reviewed journals do a great job publishing both sides of, or many sides of every issue, and that there's a, you know, open discourse going on about scientific subjects. But from talking to scientists, which I do in the show, it sounds like that's not actually the case, that you pretty much have to be a member of the club.
Very much so, but it's getting easier. It's getting easier.
Good.
Unless you've got something that is very politically scary. I mean, I'll give you an example. Actually, I quite like to give you an example, which is a very recent study which I carried out with some colleagues in Iraq on the effects of uranium. What we did was we looked at the concentration of uranium in the hair of the mothers and fathers of children with congenital anomalies in Fallujah.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big study. And what we did was, and as a result of these measurements, we found that there was a significant excess of uranium in the hair of these parents, you see. So we sent this along to the journal. But just about that same time, lots of people started writing to the journal and saying that Chris Busby's a nutcase, you know, and all his work is just informed by madness and, you know, and stuff like this. And the journal got so scared that they wrote to me and said, we're not going to even send it for review. You have to withdraw it. This was the journal editor somewhere in the United States, and he wrote to me and he said, I'm not going to consider this paper at all.
Which journal?
You know, normally they would send it to a referee, but this time they didn't even send it to the referee.
Which journal is that?
It's the it's the International Journal of Environment and Public Health.
Hmm. And this is a study about the use of depleted uranium in Iraq?
Yeah. It's a study to try. You see, they did. We did do a study which received an enormous amount of interest on the internet, which was published by the same journal, International Journal of Environment and Public Health. And I imagine that once they published that, they got an awful lot of flack from people saying, you know, this chap Busby is some sort of maverick, and you know, what were you doing publishing his paper and this and that. But anyway, they published it, and it had, I think, 16,000 downloads. It's up there on the internet because it's an internet journal. It's not a really great journal, you know, but I mean, it is a journal, and so we decided to follow this up because we had found, I think, huge increases in infant mortality, huge increases in cancer. We found, I think, a 38-fold increase in cancer, in leukemia, in men and women under the age of 35. Unheard of epidemiological result. Unheard of. And we were on Al Jazeera, and we were on Russia Today, and we were on the BBC, we were on everything, okay, talking about this. So it must have brought all of the anti-people out of the woodwork. And so when we went and sent our paper to them showing that the cause was the uranium in the hair of the parents, they said, we don't want to even look at this paper, take it away.
Now, we've been using depleted uranium as a weapon enhancer in many theaters at this point. We used it in Kosovo, is that right? And
yeah.
Used it in Iraq and Afghanistan now.
Used it in the Balkans, not just in Kosovo. You used it in the Balkans. It was used against the Serbs in Bosnia.
That's right. And so that sounds like that's going to have huge health consequences, not only for the citizens who live there, but, I mean, also the United States' soldiers who served in good faith over there. So that sounds like a pretty horrible outcome for basically something that's completely unnecessary.
No, it's not unnecessary. If you want to win a war, win the war. They've got a new weapon now which uses uranium not just as a penetrator, but uses it in order to increase the blast in some way, demolishing houses and so on. We're not quite sure how this is, but what we do know about it is that it was used in various theaters, and one of them was in Fallujah. And we have actually measured the stuff in the people, so we know that it was used there. And the thing about Fallujah is that our studies of Fallujah, in collaboration with the doctors at the Fallujah General Hospital, have shown levels of cancer and levels of congenital malformation that have never been reported in any study ever, even after Hiroshima. These are the highest levels of genetic damage that we have ever seen.
There's been a lot of talk of terrorists using dirty bombs, but this sounds like we're doing it ourselves.
Yes, that is precisely the case. And in fact, I think the people who use it know that they're doing it. Or if they didn't know at the beginning, they certainly know from all of the results that have come out from the various studies that there have been. They know now. And of course, this is part of the same argument, external and internal radiation, because what happens is uranium binds to DNA, and that's how these effects occur.
Yes. I know you have to go, so I just have one final question, and that is that many of these results that you're talking about, the harmful effects of radiation, have been known for years, and some scientists, like Ernest Sternglass, picked up on it and followed it up with other studies. But do you have any theory on how many scientists and even people in industry who know this is the case and the military can go forward using this technology, knowing that basically they're killing their own, and in addition to people in other countries?
Yeah, sure. I have thought about that. It's in a way, it's more interesting than the science, and I've written a book about it called Wolves of Water. What I've concluded is this, because I've met a lot of these people. I've been on some very senior committees in the EU, in the England. I've met people in the United States, all over Europe, who operate on that level. And I've decided there are three types of people involved in this research. They're people who are bad guys. They're just through and through bad guys. They know that there's a problem. They don't care. They always think that there's a reason why they should do what they do. You know, it's special pleading. So we want to win the war. We don't care if we kill the children. Those guys, they're the bad guys. And then there are guys who are idiots. Most of them are idiots, I have to say. So they're people who get to the top just by being nice to people. They have social graces. They maybe know somebody. You know, there's nepotism and so on. So they get into these big committees or on these into this exalted area of political power. For reasons that are unknown, but they're not very clever. There are quite a lot of those. That's most of them. So there's a few bastards, then there's a lot of idiots, and then you have some people who are clever that I call wimps. These are people who know that there's a problem, but they can't do anything about it because they're too frightened, they're too nervous, they're just constitutionally unable to stand up and say, look, this is wrong. And there are people like that. We know from psychological experiments that lots of people are like that. They'd rather sort of keep their head down and go with the flow, although they know what they're doing is wrong. So that's how it works.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'd like to talk to you more about that, but I'll reserve that for another time. I appreciate your work, Chris. Look forward to talking to you again.
Well, thanks to John Barkhausen for that. And yes, if you do that interview, I'd be very interested in Chris Busby's observations of people in large organizations. I think we've mentioned before that psychopaths, approximately 1% of the population, have an inbuilt advantage and a hunger to move to the top of these organizations, which is an observation that helps one understand the modern world. I think sociopaths describes rather a lot of us, because we are educated from a very early age, or perhaps I should say indoctrinated, into a large raft of fake information, a large amount of misleading ways of viewing the world. Refer to Jeff Schmidt's excellent Disciplined Minds on the audiobooks page if you want to hear more about this. I've certainly spent longer since university trying to get my head straight than I did at university learning stuff. I think the cowards largely know they're cowards, but Chris Busby leaves off category 4. I wouldn't put him in any of those three categories. Now, perhaps he's not in a large organization, and is it possible to be in a large organization and be a Brian Hoare or a Chris Busby, somebody who's got a mission and seems determined to do what they think is the right thing? My admittedly speculative thought is that as the terrible consequences of being a psychopath, a sociopath, or a coward start to become ever clearer to people, more and more people will be avoiding any of those designations and getting on and trying to do the right thing. We're now going to have a short but confusing piece about nuclear energy. You may wonder, is this for it or against it? The clue is, of course, that they're trying to confuse you.
I'm against nuclear power because I care about my children. But maybe then I should be for it, because they'll need energy too, and fossil fuels in 50 years' time, there won't be any left. There are renewable energies, but will that be enough? In the meantime, with them, there's no waste, but nuclear power. That said, the quantity of really radioactive waste isn't that big, a thimble per year per person. Multiplied by the number of people, that's a pretty big thimble. There are solutions, although storing them... But at least then we know where they are, because the CO2 produced by oil and coal, hello greenhouse effect. On the other hand, there's the risk with the power plants. Although in matters of safety, there's no place more safe. In the end, nuclear energy is a source of problems. And at the same time, it's a source of solutions.
And you, are you for or against nuclear energy? Or don't you use electricity?
And we're now going to hear a Democracy Now! Interview from a couple of weeks ago.
Three U.S. senators called for a congressional probe on Thursday on safety issues at the nation's aging nuclear plants. The request from Democratic Senators Barbara Boxer of California, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, and independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont comes following a pair of new exposés by the Associated Press. In a special series called Aging Nukes, the AP revealed that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear power industry have been working in tandem to weaken safety standards to keep aging reactors within the rules. Just last year, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission weakened the safety margin for acceptable radiation damage to reactor vessels.
The AP report also revealed radioactive tritium has leaked from 48 of the 65 U.S. commercial nuclear power sites, often into groundwater, from corroded buried piping. Leaks from at least 37 of those facilities contain concentrations exceeding the federal drinking water standards, sometimes hundreds of times the limit. We're joined now from Boston by Jeff Dunn, who wrote the exposés for the Associated Press, the national writer for the AP and member of the AP investigative team. Jeff, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out your exposés one at a time, what you found in light of what happened in Fukushima, what we're dealing with here in this country?
Well, there are two big ideas. One is that, as you summarized, the nuclear industry and their government regulators have been working together to lower safety standards as aging nuclear systems and parts and plants come close to violating those standards and those rules. And that's been a pattern for decades now, and we're seeing a lot of it as these plants get older and older. The other big idea here is that the plants have had piping buried underneath, underground, covered underground for so long the piping can't be properly inspected. It's rarely looked at carefully, visually. It's rarely dug up. And it's been so long now that a lot of that is corroding. And you have leaks that we've documented at three quarters of the sites. And in fact, a government accountability office, the Congressional Investigative Arm, had a report released a day or two ago after our series. And in that, they say the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the federal regulators say there have been either leaks or spills presumably many related to aging, some not, but radioactive leaks or spills of tritium and other radionuclides at all the plants.
Well, Jeff, the picture that you paint here, is, especially when you describe what's happening at some of these plants, is really, it's amazing the extent of, in essence, the cracks, the corrosion. How exactly do they weaken the standards when they discover some of these problems at particular plants?
Well, what they do first is that the industry comes to government, typically. This is the pattern you see. Or sometimes government comes to industry and says, we've got all these parts or systems that are coming close to the standard, even sometimes violating the standard. What do we do about it? And so they set off on a round of research, and the government does some of the research. The industry does some of the research, and they find again and again that the standards can be lowered. The operative phrase that you hear and you read again and again is that the standards were overly conservative. So then they find justification to lower those standards, and suddenly a group of parts or systems that were coming close to violating rules or do violate the rules are back within the rules. The other half of it is that the regulators sometimes can't get the systems and parts back within the rules, so then they begin issuing waivers or amendments or special exceptions that still allow the nuclear plants to keep running.
I just want to go back to the tritium water. Explain the dangers of this and how this is possible all over this country and what exactly it means and what can be done to stem the leaks. I mean, you have Vermont. They are poised to shut down their plant.
That's a very good question, and it's a little bit confusing to people, I think. Tritium itself at the levels that it's been released is probably not a great health threat. It doesn't penetrate the skin very well. It's not like the gamma radiation that people were talking about in Japan. The main danger from tritium, the main health danger, is if you were to drink it. The EPA sets a limit for how much can be in drinking water. None of the leaks have entered drinking water in amounts that would violate the EPA limit so far. Part of the problem, and the GAO report I was just talking about points this out, part of the problem is that the industry and the regulators don't really have a good handle on what's happening in those pipes and vaults and all that equipment under the ground. They don't have technologies that really allow them to see that very well. So the GAO report says we don't really know about how bad the leaks are. That's one part of the problem. Another part, that's a part that bears on public health. Another part is that it raises questions about the integrity of the plants, about the integrity of their cooling systems. Some, not all, but some of this piping carries water that's used to cool the reactors. And in an emergency, as we saw in Japan, you desperately need that water to cool the reactors because the radiation produces a lot of heat, and you've got to keep it cool. So that's the other half of the problem. What do all these leaks say about the integrity of that piping? And even in a broader sense, about the integrity of a lot of parts that can't easily be seen in nuclear power plants, like all those miles of electrical cable underneath the power plants that are needed by the operators to see what's going on in the plant.
And
so
Jeff,
it raises a lot of questions that trouble engineers.
Jeff, doesn't the presence of tritium also indicate that probably other radioactive materials like strontium or cesium might also be leaking from these plants?